This is a Wild Deer Production podcast.
Welcome to another edition of Roll for Initiative Podcast, Volume 7, Issue 199. And this is DM Nick here, along with DM Matt.
Hello, everyone.
And DM Crispy.
How's it going?
And no Vince.
Finally.
Yes. Finally. Hey, we're running the show. We're all going to talk about our characters
and rules. Our favorite ones. Yes, and rules cyclopedia.
Yes, I'm going to talk about Sir Xandar. He's an 18th level paladin. He's so awesome. No. Now, Vince is on vacation. Yes, he does do that from time to time. So he asked three of us to go ahead and do a show without him. So we're going to go ahead and see how we could do without the man running into things. Let's see if it doesn't go off the rails here right away.
We'll be all right.
Yeah, we might be.
Possibly.
Possibly. Maybe. We'll see. But so kind of get things kicked off. DM Matt there. How's your gaming life going? How's your in your neck of the woods?
Oh, gaming wise right now, we're actually doing a fifth edition game, playing a bard.
Okay. In it.
And we're actually using our DM is using the Tales from the Yawning Portal, so we're replaying some of the old modules in fifth ed. Right now it's a third edition module, Sunless Citadel.
Sunless Citadel.
Yeah.
Sunless. Yes.
So right now we're going through the Sunless Citadel, and through the course of going through this, our party has accumulated basically an army of goblins and kobolds at our side at this point.
Nice.
As we've been going through and freeing the slate, we had one kobold go with us as like our guide into this mess, Meepo. Uh-huh. And then along the way, we freed a slave gnome. So he joined us. And then we started freeing slave goblins as opposed to slaughtering them. And one of them was a goblin princess. So now we have about 15 goblins with us that we are like, okay, go kill that.
All right. That's cool.
Yes.
So meat shields.
Exactly. We have this. And hey, they were going to die anyway if they didn't at least try to join us. And maybe.
At least them. Die honorably.
Right. And then also this way they could possibly get their freedom and maybe we can stop the great kobold goblin war.
Possibly.
Yeah, we shall
or
see.
Or make it worse.
Yeah, one way or the other. So.
One way or the other, you got to get XP.
Yeah, but it's just humorous now that we are far outnumbered when it comes in our group because we have so many. We just keep accumulating more. It's like if you're like a zombie walk where you start off with like a few zombies and then as you go, more people just randomly jump in. That's our party, except it replaced zombie with goblin.
Wow. That sounds fun, though. Sounds like a good it's always interesting when you take monsters that you might encounter and they somehow get incorporated into the party.
Right. Yeah. When you learn to parlay as opposed to poke with sharp objects, interesting things can happen.
Yes, it can. Interesting things happen when goblins or kobolds surrender and you make them do silly things.
Right.
How about you, Crispy? How's things in Las Wages?
Good. It's cooling down. I am going to be playing in my monthly ish Curse of Strahd 5e game later tonight.
Oh,
and
cool.
And then I'm actually gearing up to start running Horde of the Dragon Queen, for my players. But I'm going to do it. There's a bunch of optional rules in the DMG to make it run more like you can make it run more like AD&D. You can make it run more like basic D&D. Mm. So I'm going to make it run more like basic D&D. So I'm
Horde of the Dragon Queen.
Yeah, they're going to fight Tiamat.
I'm not familiar with that.
It was the first hardcover campaign module that they do. Like, that's how they release modules now, is they're like,
level 1 to 10. Okay.
I'm waiting on Goodman Games to make that 5th edition keep on the Borderlands update. That's what I really want to run.
Yeah.
But
they're doing that?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing
that. John Goodman.
Nice.
Yeah, they're doing a bunch of things like that.
Wow.
So some of the stuff that Wizards isn't getting into, because since Wizards has the smaller release schedule, like, you're getting a book every like 3 months now as opposed to monthly.
I got to tell you, Goodman Games has a great business model, and they're just doing fantastic with everything they do right now. You know, I mean, Dungeon Crawl Classics, and now they got Mutant Crawl Classics, which now I finally got a copy of. That looks really fun. So now you can combine both worlds. Might be planning on doing in the future, but yeah, I didn't know that they were doing the whole thing with Keep on the Borderlands, doing a 5th edition take on it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they were like licensed out to basically do the or contracted out to do the work for updating it to 5th edition.
Maybe other classic modules be in the future.
Well, they're doing B1 and B2, so In Search of the Unknown and Keep on the Borderlands. I think it's like a soft start, but yeah, if they did like X2, the Isle of Dread, and Keep on the Borderlands, I would be, or like a B5, Night's Dark Darer, I would be super set. I would just run old basic D&D modules.
A 5th edition version of the Forest Oracle, guys.
Oh yeah.
I still haven't gotten a chance to read that. I have it downloaded and everything.
You're gonna read that and you're just gonna go like, what? The river's like a 5th level thief. anyway,
silly.
It is silly. But I'd like to see some of the other classic modules, like maybe the S series. You know,
yeah,
would be good. You know,
Tomb of- they just did Tomb of Horrors.
They did.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they said it in the Forgotten Realms in Chult.
Everything's going to be in Chult, or
everything is in Forgotten Realms. I forgot that's the default setting now.
Right, yeah. It's right. So they're kind of shoehorning things into that, but they also hinted about they're open for other things as well. Just from some of the panels and stuff where people are asking questions I went to at Gen Con.
Every few months or so, I'll tweet at Mike Merles demanding him to make Birthright for 5th edition.
Apparently everyone bugs them about Planescape.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, they've been getting they're very hesitant to say no.
That's good.
Spelljammer.
They're not as fond of the space hamsters. Chris Lindsay wasn't a big fan of the space hamster. So that one I think might be a little more work, at least to have it be something that you could, they produce, so that way you have access to it in DM's Guild, because that's the other thing. Once they publish, if they publish a new setting, you can make stuff for it in DM's Guild.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Too. So that's kind of the rule they have. If you sign up for DM's Guild, you have access to their content that they've made. And you, because you're doing the whole profit sharing thing with them, you make the product, they get a cut. It works out.
Huh.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's also how they're looking for new writers and people to do contracted work for them, is through the
doing it on the cheap.
Yeah.
They pay you in product.
Well, no, they actually pay you in Kizash. Yeah, what they're doing for some of these products is
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin would actually probably be better than cash at this point. It's like,
hell yeah, it would be.
Yeah, but what they do is they go and they monitor DM's Guild to see who's making product and selling product, importantly, and it's getting good results, and they'll contact you. Hey, we got this new book coming out. Would you mind making a little bit of content for it and releasing it on DM's Guild the day of release of the product? So it's like a DLC for your book.
Oh, that's cool.
So,
okay.
So they started that with Tomb of Annihilation, and they're going to be doing that for every product they do.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So.
I was telling before and let our listeners know before we got on the show, did our D6 Star Wars campaign my friend Jeff was running, which is set 4 years right after episode 3. So, yeah, that was fun last night, and it was Halloween themed in a weird fashion because all of our October games that we've done for years, it's them some sort of Halloween sort of bent on it. Either I'm running Call of Cthulhu or something kind of horror Halloween related. So our group found a bunch of like old Republic and Sith Empire ships, and one of these Sith Empire ships we're trying to get was this Interdictor class. It's called the Sarcophagus, which was the flagship for a Sith Lord from the Sith Empire by the name of Darth Lich. And there you go. So we went after him. It was very interesting how, like, you know, we couldn't get away from this docking station because everything was powering off, and like that, the Interdictor was sucking power from all these other ships. But anyway, yeah, we encountered Darth Lich. We finally destroyed him. Because the way we destroyed him, which I didn't mention before, was he was basically a Sith holocron. He was, so like in the center of his power armor, which he had dual wielding lightsabers, was a Sith holocron. And the only way you could kill him is destroy the Sith holocron, because that's where his essence was. If you think like a lich, his phylactery was the holocron. So think of it that way. So we defeated him, and then we had to go rescue the Queen of Naboo, and that went very interesting because we had intel that the 501st Legion was coming, which was headed by Darth Vader. Go there with my YT-1300 and trying to get her out and everything, yada, yada, yada. I mean, long story short, Vader force holds my YT-1300, shoot at him a couple of times, actually hit him, do damage, and we get away. So I did something Han Solo couldn't do, actually shoot Darth Vader and hurt him. So, but nobody can know because Vader will come and kill me. that would be bad. And I guess next month I'm gonna run Castle Greyhawk again, and we'll get back to that, alternating between both campaigns. So that's what we've been that's what I've been doing in my neck of the woods. So, as far as anything else, had a starred reveals. We don't have any new for this month, but if you wish to give us some starred reviews, go over to iTunes and in your search, type in Roll for Initiative and just click on the links from there and give us a review of the show. And we just might read it on the air. So you just never know. And I think with that, we will go into our first segment of Table Manners.
Typical of all the evil creatures in the world. I'd like to find one with table manners.
What, are you kidding me? I spent years cultivating the worst table manners on the planet.
Table manners.
All right, everybody. Our first segment here at Table Manners, we're going to kind of revisit something that we've done in the past, but maybe a little bit of a twist on it. What we're going to look at is the game Boot Hill and how it can be applied to D&D, or an AD&D first edition more specifically, and how we could do some of the conversion between Boot Hill and first edition and give a little bit of background on that game. It's kind of interesting on Boot Hill, how it all kind of came about, and then how you can convert your first edition AD&D campaign in the Boot Hill. And then beyond that, what you can do for a first edition D&D campaign, maybe using some of the rules out of Boot Hill in your game. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But as far as Boot Hill itself, it's interesting. It's actually, if depending on the history that you read, it's either the second or third game, role-playing game, that TSR made that was released. And it was first released in 1975. And it was in that kind of like small booklet format for original D&D. So it was kind of a game. I don't know if it wasn't necessarily a game supplement for it. It was a game in its own right.
Right.
And I guess this was a game that was, if I remember correctly, Don Kane, who was a part of that original group of TSR, who was involved with, wanted to get released. And unfortunately, Don died of a heart attack just before the game was released. So they did release it in 75. It was that first edition. It was kind of a like that small folio format,
right?
I guess for it, folio format. Yeah. Then the second edition was released 4 years later in 79. And that one's probably the one that everybody's most familiar with. That one, the second edition was around just over 10 years, just over a decade. And that's, and then there was a third final edition that was released in 1990. But the one that everybody's probably most familiar with is that second edition rule. And there was a reprint that went in 84 with a second, a different cover. But that one's had the longest run. And that's, as far as like doing a conversion, that's the one that you would use, would be the second edition Boot Hill game.
Right. And there was also the third edition in 1990 as well.
Yes. I mentioned that. The third edition in 1990, which seemed like a totally different system from what it looked like to me. Hmm. It looked really different.
Right. And you have to remember, though, when it first came out, it was more treated as a miniatures Western game than a role-playing game. So
exactly. Exactly.
Hence why
it was more... It was very combat related,
right?
It was more about just shooting it up in you know, like in, out there in the Wild West, out there like in Tombstone,
right? Because if you think about it, when this was first made, role playing games was still new. It was D&D had only been out a year.
Yep.
So therefore, that was still gaining steam. So they were war gamers. So they were going to make war games, and they're like,
right.
So they made a cowboy war game that people started. Oh, D&D's popular. Let's make some do some role playing with cowboys.
You know, and Boot Hill never really took off. There was a handful of supplements and adventures written for Boot Hill. The bulk of them came about in the second edition era of the game. I think there was, if I might count this correctly,
I think there's five.
Five supplements, and I think that includes the referee screen.
No, the referee
which screen. Has a mini module.
Yeah, the referee screen was its own separate, and then you have Mad Mesa, BH1, Lost Conquistador Mine, BH2, yeah. Ballads and Bullets, yeah. 3. Burn Bushwells, and then Range War was the last one in 84.
Yeah, technically Range War was the last one, yeah. So there was a range of basically four modules, a referee screen with a mini module inside it. So, you know, as far as like content overall of the game Boot Hill, it's probably comparable to Gamma World. Maybe Gamma World had a little bit more because it had a little bit larger following, not so much, but it did, you know.
Yeah.
I think the conversion of like Gamma World to AD&D was a little more easy to do or to understand than Boot Hill, but you could still do it. As far as doing the conversion, I think we've talked about this in the past. There is page 112 of the DMG is how you can do a conversion of like Boot Hill characters to AD&D and vice versa, converting them back and forth between both game systems. And it also has adjustments for armor class, also has the a small chart handling guns in D&D. In fact, near the very end of the rule book for Boot Hill, when you go to the very end here, they have an appendix for combining Boot Hill with other game systems. And it starts off and has a chart for, get this, regular D&D, AD&D, Gamma World, and Metamorphosis Alpha. Because Metamorphosis Alpha still was this remember, in 79, that was still supported by TSR at the time. So that was still one of the house RPGs. So there's
Metamorphosis Alpha is what became Gamma World, right?
More, yeah, essentially. Yeah, you could think of it that way. Metamorphosis Alpha is more about, if you're not familiar with it, is it's in space. You're on a giant world ship called, if I remember, the Warden. And you're the remnants of the generations left of the crew, some of them mutated and so on. So it's kind of, Gamma World kind of was an offshoot of that, but Gamma World being set on Earth in the far future. So, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Gamma World was kind of, was heavily inspired by Metamorphosis itself.
Okay.
Absolutely. So there is a direct lineage there. And they also have in the Boot Hill book, they have the weapons on converting them to AD&D. You'd be kind of surprised. And if I'm looking at this right, the chart is exactly the same as it is in the DMG here. So, the damage for a Derringer, it was a straight cut and paste thing, if you want to call it, from the one game to the other. So as far as, there wasn't any... both groups who were working on both games, they got it right as far as the conversion charts and everything. So everything would flow over rather well. And I guess also another reason why they threw in stuff like Boot Hill and Gamma World, like kind of crossovers, was, if I remember correctly, in the original Castle Greyhawk, there were areas of the dungeons in Greyhawk of Castle Greyhawk you go into, you would go get warped into a world of, like, six guns and cowboys, or another one, you go into the far future where it's post-apocalyptic. So, and that was one of the things that Gary did, and basically gave some sort of conversion rules to do those sorts of things. I thought it was interesting as far as Boot Hill, like you were saying, Matt, that it essentially was just straight up, fighting it with rifles and guns and shotguns. It was more combat oriented than more role playing. That I think kind of evolved a little bit more when that second edition came out in 79 and there was more module support for them. Then you got into a more of a role playing aspect of it. There was no, as far as I know, there was no like campaign world that was kind of set up for Boot Hill.
Well, yeah, it's just
California, the Old West.
Yeah,
you just go Old West.
Yeah,
you could go, California, or you can go into Kansas.
It's spaghetti Western. That's its setting.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I actually really like this idea, just because, and I'll talk about this later in the show when we get to is it Table Manners? Which segment am I doing?
DM Rules?
The DM Rules. There we go.
Does he even remember what segment he's doing?
Nope, I don't. It's because the casting times messed with it. I rolled a 3, but I like the idea of, like, Gary loves teleporting people. It's just a weird yeah. thing that he loves.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Just teleporting in general.
Randomly, usually.
Right. Yeah. I love the idea of playing an AD&D game completely straight for, maybe 2-3 weeks, and then pulling an Evil Dead 3 Army of Darkness on the players and having them be like medieval knights in the Old West.
That would be awesome.
Yes.
I would watch that movie, actually.
You know what? And then, yes. I could see where you're going with that. And then these undead or zombies, of skeletons, whatever they may be, are invading this old west town, and you have to stop it.
So it's like part Deadlands,
kinda. Before Deadlands was Deadlands,
right?
Yeah. So I could see something like that. That's actually a good angle to go on. That you have to stop a threat.
Yeah.
Into this other world. You know, if you're starting as your, like you're saying, your default setting is your AD&D campaign, and you go into this some sort of time warp or parallel dimension thingy, you know, you get sucked into a dimensional hole of one.
There's definitely a portal.
Yeah. Some sort of magical portal that goes to, like, I don't know, 1875 Old West in America, and you're in this town, and you're there long enough to find out that there's, like, hordes of zombies and ghouls and skeletons that are attacking the town, and you have to fight off this horde, or basically your world of magic and wonder spills over in the Boot Hill and takes it over.
Yeah.
You have to somehow stop it. And then to make it even worse, you have to stop it and then get your butt back on the other side so you won't be trapped here. There's a little twist.
Hmm. So yeah, I like this a lot. One thing I notice is like there's a courage rating.
Yeah.
And fighters are the most courageous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or bravery, rather, not courage.
Yeah, bravery. Yeah, bravery. Yeah, you're right. Bravery. So yeah, that's one angle. It definitely used to get a camp. If you're going to kind of like do a cross genre campaign, that's one way I think you could do it. Be a good way. Another one, you could do the old Valley of the Guanji angle.
I'm not familiar with that.
You ever heard of the movie Valley of the Guanji? Oh, my God.
No.
It is a movie back in the 60s where basically there's some – I'm trying to remember how it exactly went, but when they go into this valley, I think it's – maybe it's some – maybe a cattle rustlers and some – maybe a scientist. And there is like a T-Rex or something like this in this valley. And they bring it back to the civilized world. I could be totally wrong on how the plot went, but there was a dinosaur in it. But if you look up in Wikipedia, Valley of the Guanji, yeah, it's an interesting film.
It definitely reminds me of just the first time I ever played the PlayStation game Tomb Raider. In like the second or third level, like you're just going and you're fighting wolves and tigers as you're trying to like steal stuff out of tombs. Yeah. And then all of a sudden there's a T-Rex and you're like, all right, I guess this game's weird. And then you fight like ancient aliens. The introduction to the weirdness is
Aliens was a fun movie.
The introduction to the weirdness is like, all right, you know, I'm in like an ancient crypt in like Honduras, and then all of a sudden I'm in a cave and here's a T-Rex. Oop. That is a gigantic T-Rex.
Oh wow. Yep. When did I stumble across this lost world here?
Basically a Valley of the Guanji goes upon that where it's around turn of the 20th century. Guy has a rodeo. It's struggling. They got to find some more, special attractions for their show. And they go with this British paleontologist. They go into this valley in somewhere in Mexico, mm-hmm. and they find these dinosaurs still living there.
It's like King Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically.
One thing that these rules don't cover. Sorry to cut you off, Nick.
Oh, no.
That, is how does magic work in Boot Hill?
As far as magic working, as far as I know, it works the same.
Okay.
Yeah. As far as like ranges and casting times and stuff, still works. I guess the assumption is that, Boot Hill is not some parallel dimension, but it's in the future of that timeline. of the AD&D game world.
Okay.
So magic does exist. That's how I always interpret it. Yeah, because there's nothing in here as far as like anything when it comes to dealing with magic at all.
Yeah, it gives you what a cleric and a magic user, what their bravery scores would be.
Right.
But it doesn't say like if I want to throw a fireball at a group of Apaches.
You can do it.
Yeah, it just doesn't really cover how that works.
Right, yeah. Nope,
you use the regular magic rules in AD&D for that.
Yeah.
There's no special conversion.
Yeah, unless you wanted for the adventure you're running to be like, okay, this is a world without magic and steal the whole season one of Once Upon a Time, where all the fairy tale characters get transported to the real world, but they have no magic.
Now, if you're talking about clerics, there might be an issue there. Because if I remember correctly, if you lose contact with your cleric, I think it's spells above second or third level are unavailable to you.
Right, because those actually require direct contact with your deity. Whereas everything else is just kind of, you kind of know, so you can just kind of fake it. I think it's third. I think it's third level as well. And so I could see saying, you lose access to everything above this because, you can't get through to
your contact with your god.
Yep, it's long distance. Sorry, your prayers aren't reaching.
Right. So you could probably go with that angle as well. But magic users and illusionists, I don't see any issue there.
Right. And then
I would let the cleric still have their, because D&D cosmology is weird and God's got to live somewhere. So
maybe they're just sleeping and you wake them up.
I mean, they exist on different planes of existence anyways.
But here's the thing. I was just thinking of this. Playing a cleric, you go to this Boot Hill world. And you only have access to first or third level cleric spells at the beginning. But the more that you pray for your god, maybe you get a spell back here that's a higher level, a spell back there. Because you're giving acknowledgement to your god's existence. He's quote-unquote waking up from his slumber, and he's slowly gaining in power.
Right, yeah, because you could do
your job as a cleric to spread the word.
Yeah, because you could do the whole thing where the power of the deity is directly related to the number of worshipers.
Yep, that's how I do it.
Right. So therefore your god is now a forgotten god in this world. So therefore he doesn't have any power. He's
unless
it's
St. Cuthbert.
Yeah.
Because there's a St. Cuthbert in the real world.
Yeah.
Cuthbert.
Yes. Yeah. St. Cuthbert learned how to evolve with the times and keep relevant. Unlike some of the, if you were using some of the gods out of demigods and deities, if you're worshiping the old Norse gods, not really getting much help out of them because
maybe not. There's other angles you can go with that though.
Yeah. Or if you happen to pick one that still would have been maybe some of the Native American would have a little more power.
Absolutely. There you go.
So you could even do it in this world you just happen to worship the right deity, so therefore your spells have a little extra kick.
Worship Quetzalcoatl? No problem.
Yeah. And also you have to think when you show up in this world, you're going to have your weird garb, your metal armor, and people are going to be like, what the heck? What are these things? Shoot it. Especially if you are demi-human.
Right.
Burn it with fire. It's some sort of abomination. Kill it.
Mm-hmm. You also have the other issue of gunpowder.
Yeah.
And bringing gunpowder weapons back with you. You know? That could be a big problem, particularly if they get in the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. You know, orcs with shotguns. I'm not too hip to that.
See, I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm exactly hip to that.
Yeah, because at that point, you kind of have Warhammer fantasy in a weird way.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe you start to get an even playing field because eventually everybody has them.
Well, here's the thing.
It's like nuclear weapons, right? Once everybody has them, Well, then what's the point of being the just having them yourself?
Yeah, but like, are the players able to like? So in this instance, like, do you think the players are able to jump freely between Boot Hill and
that's AD&D? The thing? Because yeah, I guess it all depends.
Yeah.
Eventually,
if that's the case, like, would they think to take gunpowder back with them? If so, like, they can only take so much gunpowder,
right,
and so much ammo,
mm-hmm.
right? Because eventually, you get in situations like, how do you make the gunpowder?
Right.
How do you make the ammunition?
Or if your
technology
gun
to make it,
or if your gun breaks, how do you fix it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Or can you get plans and reproduce them on your own?
Those gnomes. Right. We have a use for gnomes now.
Aha.
Nope.
No.
Nope. You come back from a Boot Hill with your gunpowder and start the gnome genocide.
Well, I was just thinking what would happen, though, a way that the result could be if you bring back gunpowder weapons, and not just that, but the technology to maybe create them is... is metallurgy at the level to where you could create said weapons in your game world? Mm-hmm. Is there a magical angle that you can use to make those weapons work in your world? You know, maybe the metallurgy skills and knowledge isn't that high, but maybe there's a magical angle. You know,
I think if they're able to make like mithril armor, I think that, yeah, they can make a gun out of iron.
Sure.
Right. And then, but, yeah. And then eventually that leads to cannons and those type of siege weapons.
Right, right, right.
So
you would have an interesting situation. And I think it would work because if you look at the damage table, it's not all that terrible. You know?
Not really.
I mean, for a shotgun, it's 1d10 damage. That's as much as a longsword, right?
Yeah.
A derringer does as much as a dagger. I mean,
a Gatling gun, 1d8, like a longsword.
Yeah.
Some of these, it's like a Gatling gun. Are you going to get, is that per shot? Because you're going to get.
Yeah. I mean, like, is that in like a, is it like in a cone or a line?
Right. That's where I would probably drop the Gatling gun out of there, because it's obviously much more powerful than how it's statted out. It's got to be. If you know anything about the history of firearms, a Gatling gun was like the first iteration of a machine gun.
Right.
Yeah.
A multi-barreled rifle, essentially. And then, well, you have cannon here, canister shot, which is grape shot. And that makes sense for the damage there. Mm-hmm. That's not the damage from a cannonball.
Right.
That's using canister or scatter shot, basically using the cannon as a big shotgun.
Right. Hmm. And you basically get pelted with pellets and things.
And that was much more, historically speaking, that's much more dangerous than actual cannonball itself to personnel. Because now you got a whole bunch of like, you know, little balls instead of one big cannonball coming at through you. So now you got like maybe about, you know, 15, 20 of these little like, you know, big, you know, ball bearings.
Right.
They're coming at you.
Yeah. Take so your, it's like buckshot.
Yeah, it is. It's essentially a buckshot for cannon.
Right. Whereas with the cannonball is more for, I need to knock out a wall. I need to knock out a vehicle, a ship, or something large. Exactly.
Canister shot is anti-personnel primarily.
This table, so the small, medium, and long range, the pluses there, is that plus to hit or plus to damage? I feel like it's plus to damage because you're point blank.
I believe that's damage modifier.
Yeah. So yeah. Gatling gun, D8 plus two.
Well, hold on a second. No, it's not. That's range modifier.
Yeah.
Because it says damage, range modifier, short, medium, long.
Right. So that means it's more accurate up close?
Okay. Yes.
So if you're firing a derringer at short range, you get a plus two to your hit. At medium range, plus one to your to hit. Long range, there's no modifier.
Hmm.
So like shotgun, plus two at short. Medium is no modifier. Long range, minus one, which makes sense. So And dynamite, there's no modifier, but hellacious damage. But, you know, I could maybe see, you know, your point, Crispy. It could work in, you know, bringing these sorts of weapons and the technology back into your world. I mean, you know, I can already think of a Larry example of this. The Guardians of the Flame series, if you remember those,
mm-hmm.
back in the 80s, excellent books, at least in my opinion, where you had a group of people who were playing a fantasy game and they were teleported into a fantasy world, into the bodies of their characters.
Oh, like that hit summer blockbuster Jumanji starring The Rock.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, critically acclaimed summer blockbuster Jumanji.
Don't even remember it. I remember the original Jumanji with Robin Williams.
Jumanji did not do that well. That's the joke.
Yeah, I get it. I didn't even know if it was released. No idea. I didn't know the reboot was released. But anyway, so they have to make their way through this world and live in it. They can't get back to Earth. And one of the side effects is to get to somehow a few of the characters basically carve out a little fiefdom or kingdom of their own and try to bring gunpowder technology into the world. And they do. And they start taking over places. So imagine like, you know, an army of dwarfs with like blunderbusses, and then you got yourself a thing. But yeah, there's not only that in the game as far as like, you know, converting it back and forth, which doesn't seem much of a chore. What I found interesting as when I was going through the rules for Boot Hill was, you know, I think there's a few things in the Boot Hill rules that would be useful for using in AD&D. And I was looking through the combat rules, and what I thought would be better to use than what's in AD&D is the rules at Boot Hill for brawling. Because as far as I've ever played AD&D, I hated using the grappling and overbearing rules and stuff in there because they seem so complex.
I remember Jason did an episode where he like ran through the whole scenario and like tested to see how accurate they were.
Yeah. And it wasn't. it was just a big mess. I remember the episode that went over as just as good as the episode we did in trying to do psionics.
Oh, God. Psionics are a mistake.
But here's the thing on brawling, basically the rules for this, it depends if you're punching or grappling. So you declare if you're going to punch or you're going to grapple. And for brawling, it's two rounds of brawling. And you have to choose if you're punching or grappling. And then you roll two D10, essentially, and you add them together. And then you consult the chart, and then it gives the result. And whatever result happens, according to Boot Hill rules, you lose strength from that. You get, if I remember correctly. So basically it goes down to, so if I roll 2d10, you add the result, like for punching. Let's say I rolled a 12. That's a glancing blow from punching, and that's 1 point of damage according to the punching roll, or you lose your opponent loses a point of strength. Now, I guess you could do it like maybe hit points or maybe constitution, depending how you wanted to do the damage. Normally, I would do like, I normally do like a just do it to a hit roll when you punch somebody and you just do your strength bonus damage. But this gives you options here of like, of the different types of punches, block, glancing blow, jab hook combination, rabbit punch, uppercut, and 19 or more is a haymaker.
Hmm. That sounds similar to the second edition AD&D. It's like striking
rule. Yeah, they might have borrowed from it for all I know.
Yeah, because that chart had, because from what I recall of that, it has a similar chart for throwing like punches, and it lists those exact type punches in it. So
right, according to Boot Hill, and I did read this correctly, the effect is that the number of points damage done is deducted from the opponent's strength. But you could maybe substitute something else. Maybe you're sapping down that person's constitution, or you can do hit points of damage, I suppose, actual hit points damage. If you want to use this sort of chart when it comes to punching and grappling, pretty much the same thing. It's sapping from the person's strength. I guess I would use constitution, but that's just me. It's the same sort of mechanic. 2d10, you add the results. They add a result of that, then you look up the result, and then you look on the next part of the chart, and that's the number of points that are sapped away from strength or constitution, mm-hmm. whatever you want to use. It's really simple.
Yeah.
It's really simple.
And
so that's one way I think you can actually take rules from Boot Hill and use them here in the AD&D themselves.
Yeah, far simpler than the overbearing.
So much simpler.
Yeah. And I think that's just one flaw of pretty much any RPG system. I've yet to find one that has a good grappling system.
Right.
Because how do you properly create a rule set that can take into account, oh, you lock this hold on, you break a bone. You right. break the guy's arm, or you grab a choke and choke them unconscious.
Right. That's that whole thing. It's like, what is real damage to the character and what is just like,
right,
you're just wearing them down.
Right. It's like, because you could go and just transition, like, do two arm bars, you break both their arms, then you knee bar them twice, break both their legs. They're still alive, so they're not dead. But they're
taking damage.
But they're not functional either. It's a weird, for the purpose of the game, it's a weird thing to try to represent, because then you get into the horribly complex charts and rules of, well, if this body part has this, and I think that's like the flaw of any grappling
system. Yeah.
Striking, like throwing punches and kicks and things, I think is a far simpler thing in a game to simulate than it is grappling.
I mean, there are some things, though. It's like, okay, the total after effects of damage is it going to be like real damage every time you do that? Because if you do, you're just punching everybody till they die.
Right.
Or grappling them till they just pass out and die. I guess one way around that is you could do something like this. Maybe it's like a 2-for-1 ratio. Every 2 points of damage is like subdual, well, and that is equal to 1 point of real damage. Something like that. You know what I mean?
Right. And there's a lot of games where the unarmed combat it defaults to subdual.
Right.
You're doing subdual. You're not able to do lethal damage with.
Yeah, but you could beat somebody to death. Technically, it's happened in real life.
Right. So. Exactly. And again, it's then if my punch does 4 points, and it'll always do 4 points because like my strength modifier or whatever.
Right.
Why would I ever
maybe
use
half of that is real.
Right.
Half of that's real and half of that's and the rest of it's subdual damage.
Right. But then why would I ever use a dagger? My fist is better than this dagger, which isn't
true. But it technically isn't.
And I think that's where distinguishing between like real life and gaming, and sometimes you just have to make concessions for the sake of gameplay.
I mean, I think an easy way of doing it, now that I'm thinking about it, is your subdual damage is drawn from your constitution score. So you kind of use that. Your real damage is drawn from your hit points. So let's use your example of like, you know, punching somebody. Say you do 4 points of, the end result is 4 points, okay? four is sapped from your con, but two actually is taken away from your hit point. So, you know, two real damage, four subdual damage, if you want to call it subdual.
Right.
That's not too difficult.
No,
I think unless you get into fractions. Oh, I did 3 points of damage.
What? The one thing
round
is
down.
But then the Munchkin would go, okay, well, we're fighting this higher level character than us that we can't take in just combat because they have so many hit points. But if we subdual them, his constitution's probably only like 16, 17. So then right. They just start pulling out their slapjacks and like punching this like eighth level fighter or whatever, as opposed to battling him with a sword.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess I could see that too.
Because it's an interesting thing when having to be able to distinguish between weapons and unarmed, and I think just this conversation explains why there's no such thing as a really great grappling rule set.
Right. But the only you gotta admit, the ones that are in Boot Hill, they're a lot simpler than ones in AD&D, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. And if you think of it, if you're using these rules as a miniatures game, it makes perfect sense.
Right.
If you go in it from that miniature game mindset, yep, you're like, okay, yeah. It's just once you start incorporating role-playing and then you start trying to get into that more world simulation as opposed to board gamey, then it starts like, well, what about... So,
well, I don't know if anybody else has anything to add to it, but I think we covered that pretty well. You got anything else there, Crispy? Or
nah?
Okay. No. Well, you should be able to find the Boot Hill rules out there somewhere and on the interwebs or Drive Through RPG and stuff like that. And yeah, and check it out. There might be some things like the grappling rules in there, the unarmed combat in there. I also thought that maybe the tracking chart, how to do tracking, might be something to convert over in the AD&D. You could use that specific thing.
Right.
That would help.
Yeah.
But you never know. There's some good stuff there, and it could make it work and make a campaign even much more interesting. So. I think with that, we'll go on to our next segment of DM Rules.
Are you enjoying the show you're listening to right now? Want to help support the show? Why not head over to the Patreon site, patreon.com/WGP. That's patreon.com/WGP. And help support the network for as little as $1.50 a month. That's right, $1.50 a month goes a long way. Thank you.
I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want, but I have a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you.
DM. All right, this episode on DM Rules, we're going to talk about using curses in the game. Vince had found, I think it was Vince, I'm not sure who actually found this, found a set of rules that kind of expand curse rules. And does some pretty neat things, some pretty fun things. It's very, very flavorful. It's very much, these are rules for gypsy curses. Like, that's the only way that I could explain this.
The gypsy gives you the stink eye, huh?
Yeah, like there's one that's called the idle hand. It's a lot of like voodoo and gypsy curses.
Yeah, right.
And they're really cool. So kind of touching on how curses work in the game by default, I went through the DMG and the player's handbook and looked through every instance of the word curse. It's really, aside from cursed items, it's really just a reversed bless spell. So, so it's what, negative one to hit and
negative to the saving throws.
Negative to saving throws. Yeah.
Right.
But then you do get some fun stuff when you kind of break into cursed items. A couple ones that I had brought out, and Gary mostly uses cursed items for yucks, from what I can tell.
Yeah.
You've got, like, the Ring of Contrariness, which makes you, when you put it on, you will do your best to disagree with whatever is said and do the opposite of what people want you to do. He even made a point to say, like, oh, if someone says that you shouldn't hit yourself in the head, the ring will have you agree with them. It won't let you have harm. Then, you know, there's, like, the Boots of Dancing, which are just boots of Tasha's hideous laughter that work the same way as any other beneficial boots until you're in combat. So a lot of Gary's curses are, like, wait for the right moment and, like, spring it on people.
Yeah, you got them in artifacts or regular magic items, like the Cloak of Poisonousness.
Mm-hmm.
You put it on, it's poison, you die.
Yeah, the Chime of Hunger was one. It works just like a Chime of Opening. Yeah. He even says, like, oh, let it first few times they use it, it's just a regular Chime of Opening. And then when it really counts, activate the curse.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's, so another one I had seen, there aren't really a lot of beneficial curses. Aside from, like, maybe the Sword of Plus One, Cursed, which is basically just Stormbringer or the Sword of Fighting from Journey Quest.
I'm trying to remember. There's another. It doesn't really start off as a cursed item, but there is a bad side effect to it where I think it's the Cloak of the Bat. It's from, I think it's from a module. I want to say it's from Dwellers of the Forbidden City, if I remember correctly. It's like you get this cloak. I wish I could find the darn module to be absolutely sure. But you put the cloak on and you can, I believe you can metamorphosize. You can turn into like a, I think a vampire bat, but each time that you use it, here's a cumulative percentage chance you'll be permanently a vampire bat. So, yeah.
The Cloak of the Bat ended up being just like a staple magic item in later editions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's the Cloak of the Manta Ray in the DMG.
Yeah.
But yeah. We also have another article from a Dragon magazine. I believe this is Dragon number 77. It's on page 112. It's called Curses, 20 Good Ideas for Bad Things by Ed Greenwood. I'm going to kind of touch on these and then get into the other curse article that had started this. But Ed Greenwood's curses, I think they're kind of lackluster. I'll just run down a couple of them. One of them is the recipient of the curse or otherwise character reading a scroll or otherwise directly activating a curse, or who is touched by a bestow curse, is surrounded by a vivid yellow-orange fairy fire that lasts up to 2 hours unless dispelled, which is fine. That's okay. Sure. Like,
okay. It's annoying. You
know, yeah, cursed scrolls, I think, are one of my favorite things about curses. You know, just the default, you get polymorphed into a monster. You get turned into liquid and drained away. Again, teleported.
Right.
Teleported. I think it's teleported 1,200 feet or miles?
Yeah.
Explosive runes, which I would not do damage. I would have it work like it would be real Looney Tunes-y in my version of D&D where, you know, it blows up. Maybe like Daffy Duck. Yeah, like Daffy Duck, his beak is missing kind of thing.
Okay.
Or like those joke cigars that you'll see, like, you know, Elmer Fudd smoke. Like bugs will give Elmer Fudd and it'll blow up and his face will be scorched.
Gotcha.
And then the demagicking of an item.
That's
just real gotcha moments.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
All the gold is turned to lead.
Oh.
Yeah, that's one from this one, which is like, that's just mean. That's like a mean thing. Like, making me into a girl is one thing, but, like, taking away all of my hard-earned gold? That sucks.
Hey, it's a good way to balance the economy.
but it's all of your gold. So it's a good way to tank the economy.
Yeah. Hey, but if you need to make bullets for your six guns.
Oh, yeah, for your six guns.
There you go. There you go. See? Here's an upside.
One of the ones that Ed Greenwood had written was all drawn or held weapons are snatched from every character's grasp and levitated toward the ceiling. Continue upward for 100 feet or more at the DM's option, remaining there for 1 to 4 turns. A turn in AD&D in basic D&D, it's 10 minutes. Is that the same in AD&D?
Yes.
Okay. So, they just hang out there for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And then they drop, and if a creature is hit, it says it does considerable damage. 5d6, which is a lot, but I guess it's just transferring its falling damage onto the person hit.
That's assuming they, I guess, like are levitated up 50 feet.
Yeah. Like, well, 5d6 is the base damage, and it's like, why though?
Yeah, that could kill a lot of people.
Yeah. Gold carried. So I don't care for these that much. I much prefer Gary's curses because it's just him messing with his buddies, is my interpretation of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Gary's curses were more along the lines of fairy trickster curses as opposed to trying to kill you curses.
Yeah, they are very mischievous.
Right.
Which I like. I would suggest if you're going to use curses, that seems like the more fun, more amicable way to do it rather than like really getting out to get the players. But I'm also not a out to get the players DM.
Right. Like the last one on this art or the number 19.
I usually think my players are out to get to me.
Yeah. It's like I'm looking at this. There's the one that summons the storm that causes lightning bolts to rain down, doing 3d6 damage. And then it's just like, and you roll d6 once per round for 8 rounds, and on every 5 or 6, another bolt shoots a party member. It's like, what the? Yeah.
That's like definitely different from like walking through an archway that makes you into an old man.
Right. Well, I guess that just shows you there's varying degrees of curses that you can bestow. I mean, it depends on, I guess the severity, the whatever, how do I put this? Whatever that cursed person did should determine the degree of the curse. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to look at it that way, if it's just something like totally random, they come across a cursed scroll, I don't think the curses should be all that damaging.
No.
But if you're talking like a curse from like, from a witch, I don't know, from like a witch, then there's if she's going to curse a particular character or characters, then that is going to be varying degrees.
Yeah. And that's a good segue into the article. Because these are curses that are specifically targeted against someone who has wronged you. Right. So this comes from a blog called The Critical Fumble. That's their website is thecriticalfumble.blogspot.de, and it's entitled My Take on Curses. And just kind of a quick rundown, there's 4 tiers of curses. Any level of caster can cast any tier, but if you try to bat outside your weight class, bad things will happen to you. And they're really just, they're gypsy curses. So when you get into the tier one, you have like idle hands, which you have to save versus magic, or the victim's hand loses feeling and falls limp after an hour or so. And then after a week, the hand begins to gain a mind of its own. The only remedy is to remove the hand.
The one I find horrifying is remove tongue.
Yes, that was awful.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a second level tier. Save versus magic, or the victim's tongue shrivels up and falls out of their mouth, turning into a pile of flies and maggots as it hits the ground.
That's horrible.
Yeah. And these are much different than what you would do with the bestow curse or curse spell. These are basically rituals. A lot of them have casting times of a week, 12 hours, a whole day.
Yeah.
A lot of that demonic doesn't
offspring. Oh boy.
Make sense to me with how long it is. Like, let me find. Yeah, like Searing Hatred is an hour, right?
Right.
It targets anyone in the same plane of existence. There's also some stuff where the touch range, I like the effects of these. It's just like the rules, I don't think makes a lot of sense. But yeah, fourth tier curses they're pretty good. You get stuff like Plague, where you can create a contagious plague that begins where you see fit. And then once the curse takes effect, the grain begins to wilt and spread the disease. Livestock dies. People grow boils and blisters all over their bodies. The first to die are within a few weeks, like the bubonic plague, basically. And then you get like rivers of blood. All rivers and streams in a radius up to 100 square miles turn to blood.
You know, some of these are just, I think, way too powerful.
Well, these, like the fourth tier, these curses
are... You have to be 15th to 20th level.
Right. These are more campaign curses where you have to go on the quest to solve this, because the way to get rid of the plague or the way to get rid of the river blood, you have to kill the caster. Well,
okay.
Yeah. Well, river blood can be...
Plague of Locusts. That would be a good one.
Yeah. And then we can't forget about Cast in Darkness, where you can basically cause a permanent solar eclipse.
Yeah, so, I saw that. I'm like, holy
man. Yeah, and if you fail, you turn into a pile of goo. So that is River of Blood's actually the example they use. At first level, Wizard tries to use Rivers of Blood. They have to make a save at -6 at the beginning of the ritual. And if they fail, then they're dead, basically. It backfires and you don't get to play the game anymore.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. I love that example. Oops, she failed the roll. Now it turns into a pile of steaming goo.
There's only one third tier curse, which is Slow Polymorph, which basically, you know, over time, it's sort of like the book Thinner is what I think of when I read this.
Yeah.
But they basically the victim makes saving throws versus magic 3 times a day over 3 days. And on a failed save, they begin, you know, to feel the effects. And eventually they turn into whatever you turn them into.
Right. Huh. Yeah, that can also be very Lovecraftian, too, depending on what you're morphing into. So you could be morphing into some sort of abomination over those few 3 days. And so every time you look in the mirror, you see a little more.
Yeah, I definitely like these options just because they work more like curses from literature or folklore. And if they're definitely more personal than I think any of the other curses that we've used as examples, like, you know, the bestow curse spell is, you know, it just kind of inconveniences someone,
right,
which is kind of what I think curses should be.
Right.
Ed Greenwood's curses are sort of like, they're a little gonzo for me. They're a little like, and too mean-spirited. These ones are very mean-spirited, but by design. This is, you know, there's one called Seething Hatred, where you curse someone and they become an unstoppable rage monster. Where you just, these are the rituals you perform if you want to ruin someone's life.
Yeah. And
I don't know who these are for, though. Like, I don't know if this is supposed to be players casting them against other players, or if they're, like you had mentioned, Matt, if they're supposed to be, some of them are like campaign curses. But, you know, like, if a guard slights you and you cast Idle Hands on him, are you going to find that guard again? Like, I'm not sure who these are for.
Right. I would say these are more for your NPCs, because when you look at it, at the top, it says that these things should be really difficult to come by and dangerous to use because they're so powerful. Mm-hmm. But it, so like one, I would treat it like a spell. You would have to, one, find the curse to mm-hmm. know how to perform it if you're a player. And then you have to get all the items because it, for the components. And that, and again, yeah. is kind of a quest itself because it's very specific on exactly what you need. And some of these things are a little gruesome. Like, you need the bottled breath of a dying man, a gnome's nose. Yeah. So, Crispy, you can't use the ghastly vision. I'm sorry, since nope. you don't have gnomes.
I could just substitute them. It could be a third of a dwarf's nose, a third of a halfling's nose, and a third of an elf's nose.
Right. And then some of these also require you – you have to get like a lock of hair of the person you're cursing.
Mm-hmm.
The demonic offspring, demon, blood of a demon, teeth of a newborn relative, and a boiled cat tail. So you're doing some gruesome stuff just to get this. And then when you get to the fourth tier, it's like you got to sacrifice a child. And then you need a bar of gold worth 400 gold and a pound of flies and you need pig feces. And
yeah, go to the fly store.
Oh, that's everybody could go get that stuff, right?
Yeah, take a number and come up to the counter and be like, I'd like a pound of flies.
Pound of flies.
Like, oh,
right.
Do you want horse or house?
Right. Horse, please.
Yeah.
And then they carve off from the block of flies and like, is this good? You're like, no, a little bit thinner, please.
I like it thinner, you know. Yeah. I want deli cut.
Yeah. And then some of these have to be cast during a solar eclipse, like cast in darkness and rivers of blood. Has to be done during a solar eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have all those items.
Must be cast while playing a Slayer elf.
Right. So you could even make the campaign as someone's trying to cast this and you have to thwart them. They're going around trying to get the components. You got to stop them. And then you know the time frame of when they have to cast this spell.
Since yeah. Cue the dark dungeons.
Right.
Yeah. So.
The material component for cast in darkness is a discarded gum wrapper.
Yeah, I don't
gum doesn't exist in my D&D world.
Right. Well, that maybe you need to go to Boot Hill.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
You go to Boot Hill or Gamma World.
A minute. There you go. In order to create a curse, you have to get something from another world like Boot Hill, like you said.
Yeah.
There's a good tie-in.
Oh, you could, like, my hypothetical movie about knights ending up in the Old West to stop an ancient evil. Mm-hmm. Definitely, like, maybe the big bad is trying to, like, do cast in darkness and maybe, like, I don't know, like a shaman, I guess? Whoever is doing magic in Boot Hill, who knows about it, brings the heroes forth to try to stop this curse from happening.
Right.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Or the big bad goes to Boot Hill because they're going to the Old West to get that giant 400 gold piece bar of gold. So they're going to the
they're
going to
go panhandle for it.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah. Yeah, this article, it has some interesting stuff, but yeah, it's not something that your players are going to be sitting around throwing at villains during combat.
Yeah.
And really, depending on your alignment, some of these things you're just not going to cast anyway.
Mm-mm. These are definitely evil things.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, maybe what it's like the alignment-changing helmet. That's a cursed item. Maybe they do that, and that gives them the idea. Like, now they're... It was like a lawful good paladin who is now a blackguard. Yeah. That's right. That's listeners.
Mm-hmm.
What you've been reading as a blackguard your whole lives is actually pronounced a blackguard. That's real. Yeah. Now he like he becomes an anti-paladin and wants to destroy the world. And this is what he's doing to do that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of juice here. I like this a lot.
Right. Yeah, I do too, because this is it. If you look at it from a campaign storytelling standpoint, it's super flavorful, and there's just a lot you can do to this is your adventure. I mean, the curse is the adventure is a so, but yeah, definitely like it. And then not to mention, if you need more ideas, just go and start reading fairy tales. Read the old Grimms and Hans Christian Andersen and all that, and just steal. It's like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I feel like a good thing with these curses from the Critical Fumble would be coming up with ways to break the curse. Like, especially stuff like demonic offspring or slow polymorph. Those are things that take a while to take effect.
Right.
So there might be a chance, however, of reversing the curse, but it, you know, that chance goes down after X amount of time.
Yeah, like right. Say an evil witch cast demonic offspring on the king and queen of the land's son, and you find out about it, and it's like, oh, now I have to, like, I can't kill the prince before he kills the king, because then they'll kill me. But this kid is definitely going to kill its family at some point.
Right. And this kid is
we need that to not be a thing.
Right. This kid is definitely the Star of Omen.
Maybe the curse, the final duration, you know, the go into full effect would be without any, you know, the point of no return would be like a year and a day. You know?
Yeah.
So a year and a day from the time the curse was cast, you have to hopefully time to remove the curse.
Well, yeah, that could be like applicable with some of them. The demonic offspring one is it's a real Sleeping Beauty kind of curse where you cast it on the fetus.
Right.
And then the child shows early on stage, like they show signs of their sadistic nature.
Right.
Like they have a tail.
Yeah. And the demonic offspring one is also one typically that the big bad would announce to the world, I have done this. Ha ha ha. You're screwed.
You have now a year and a day to reverse the curse if you can.
Yeah, that could be a whole. That's a whole adventure there.
That's could be a whole chunk of a campaign right there.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because then you could even take and make it where they part of it is figuring out how to do it. Then they have to go and hunt down all the stuff that lets them undo it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's part of the adventure. Then you have the big bad that started it trying to thwart them. And yeah, you get a whole nice little epic story arc here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could. That's really cool. I like that. Well, I think we covered a lot of good things about curses here, unless you guys have anything else.
No, not relevant to the discussion. Like, I had some stuff about like lycanthropy, but we'll save that for later.
Okay. Well, actually, the stuff about curses might be a real good segue into our next segment of Creature Feature, what Matt is going to cover. So let's move on to Creature Feature.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5-foot long gorilla?
Creature Feature Theater.
Now in the Creature Feature, we are going to take our curses and go and start talking about those who actually would spread these curses. I'm actually pulling out an NPC class from Dragon, the Witch, because they're actually...
How do you know she's a witch?
She weighs as much as a duck, because I am a man of science. She weighs as much as a duck.
She turned me into a newt.
And I got better. So,
all right, now that we got that out of the
way. Yes, now that we got the obligatory Monty Python references out of the way, we can continue. Because you'll notice the witch is not in the monster manual. Because it's a human, and they decided not to stat out like what a witch would be. So, because the closest thing you'd have in like the monster manual would be like your hags and things of that nature, but it's still not really a witch. So they went and made this NPC class in Dragon number 114 on page 8, and Yeah, it's an NPC class because when you start reading about what they gain, you don't want your players being able to do this. Just trust me.
Yeah.
You really don't. Because as they go up in level, they get some unique abilities. And this is totally based off your fairy tale witches, the ones passing out the poison apples and having princesses prick themselves on spinning wheels and falling asleep. Those type of witches.
They first had the witch. There was one version that they had real early on.
They had an OD&D one.
Well, yeah, issue number 43. Then they revised it in the one issue that you're talking about. That was the most current one at that time. Right. They revised and expanded it, and that's the good one to go with.
Right. Because they get their spells, and this article actually has like their spell list in it. But the way they get their spells is, this is one where there's going to be severe alignment restrictions to your witches, because to get their spells, they gain them by performing ritual sacrifice and prayers to their deity, usually demon princes, archdevils, or the current Oni Daemon. Yeah, if they're pleased, they will come and teach them new spells. That's how you gain your spells. So you got to do sacrifices. Also with these, I mean, it lays out all like the stats for your hit points and all of that, but what I'm more interested, and it goes into like the orders, and it's has a hierarchy kind of thing, like how the druids are. When it comes to the higher up you get, you have your rankings. But then this, what I'm mostly interested in with this NPC class is their special abilities. Because as at the third level, a third level character, they get to brew a dose of a potion once a day. Or a narcotic, which is kind of powerful when you think about it. Hey, how many parties would love to have like one of their third level characters be able to crank out like a healing potion a day, or like a potion of strength?
That'd be nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, your witch can. So
it's what you're doing for a month locked in our room.
Right. Whereas the witch is just like, here, let me brew it up. Hey, actually, this would make a great NPC for that place, that store that has all the potions of seems like everything you could ever want, run by a witch.
There you go.
I don't do like the magic emporium in my games, but I definitely do have like magic stores that they sell love potions and like fertility drugs and things that will help your crops grow.
Right. Yeah. It's more of closer to like a herbalist than it is the ye old magic buffs.
Well, yeah. No, like it's not a shop where you can go buy a +1 longsword, but peasants aren't going to know the difference between like what is real magic and what is snake oil.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What's this herbal lore and remedies and yeah.
And it's like with this, like they get a type, they can brew like a type A poison at the third level. They also get like an additional type of ingestion poison for every two levels. So all your poisons, hey, your assassin may want to make a witch friend. They also get the sleep narcotic. So therefore, they can start casting the sleep spells to knock out all the princesses. Then fourth level, they're brewing their truth serum. Then here's Crispy's love potion at level 5. It basically works as the
Crispy's love potion. Does it say that?
Yeah, yeah, right here. Boom. But yeah, you get that
Crispy's love potion number 5.
Love potion number 5.
But with this one, they can only brew once a week. Same with the truth drug. So, like your poisons and things, they're just cranking out daily. That could be a nice little side gig for them. But the truth drugs and lipos takes a little longer, takes a week. But it works just like the spells.
Well, what I found interesting about the witches, the NPC class, was, and I must have forgotten about this from years ago, because this is something I've actually incorporated to my AD&D game, I give bonus spells to magic users based off intelligence. Witches get that same thing.
Hmm. Right.
I had no idea. If you look at the article, they get above average intelligence. They get bonus spells similar to clerics. And it's cumulative like clerics.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you look at the actual mechanics of the class, it's very similar to like your other magic users and clerics. Oh, yeah. It's like a hybrid of the two.
Yeah.
And then with the main difference being all the stereotypical witch skills they end up accumulating over time.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of really awesome, flavorful, folklore-y witch skills, like candle magic, making potions.
Yeah, the candle magic is one. They make the magic candle and they light it, and as long as the candle's lit, that effect's going in. Like, they have the red mm-hmm. candle, which is the love candle, and you have to either snuff the candle or you have to use, like, limited wish or alter reality to break it. The purple candle is the truth drug. Yellow candle, you get one turn of telepathy is gained for each turn of burning.
Hmm.
So you could then the gold candle cures 1d6 damage on any being affected. Being able to be affected by the cure light wound spell on the nearest candle when the latter is extinguished for each turn of burning. If the witch puts out the candle, she herself is cured.
Hmm.
So it's like, oh, I cure you. You go away. Poof.
I think this is even more awesome after 7th level and 9th level. You can use all magical scrolls.
Yeah.
Druid, magic user, illusionist, magic user, doesn't matter. You can use them.
Yeah.
And then, like, eventually they can make permanent magic items.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't need to recharge. Hey, I got the Wand of Fireball Unlimited. Enjoy.
Oh, jeez.
Nice.
Right. They also...
There's a campaign breaker.
Yeah. Control doll. So the old creepy lady starts passing out dolls to do her bidding.
They have a very different take on the familiar for the witch NPC class.
Right. With this, except that there's no chance of... Yeah, the power is... It's similar to the magic user, except that there is no chance of not getting a familiar. And they're powerful because they add the hit points to the witch. But the familiar dies, the witch only loses hit points of the familiar added, not double.
Right.
Familiars are as tough as a witch are to locate. If her familiar dies, a witch must wait 3 to 18 years to acquire another.
That's the big negative.
Right. And they usually have bizarre names. And
Mephistopheles.
Bad puns. Yeah. However, a witch's familiar is capable of human speech and has high intelligence and considered cleverness and has an AC5 with 2D hit points. And then it gets them like +1 to hit and damage rolls. Possession of a familiar gifts the witch the ability given by the Pearl of Power, type determined by the familiar. And then they have a telepathic bond with them. And special familiars may be required as the magic user, and then they have like the maximum number of hit points and all that too. So it's like,
yeah
the familiar on steroids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then as you just keep going, it's like they get the power fascination once a day. Longevity, they age only 1/10, so hence how you can have the really old creepy lady living up in the cottage out in the woods that no one goes near, that's been around mm-hmm. forever. And then they get limited wish at 21. Yeah. Because why not?
That's pretty good. It's just an ability that they have.
Once per month. And hey, they got the longevity, so they're at that point. Hey, what's a little bit of age?
They have to be 21st level, though. So they're so far up on the chain that...
Yeah.
Yeah, but also, this is not a, like... I would just, this is just stuff witches could do. Like, I would not break it down like that. It's like, oh, you find a witch and she's got all the abilities.
Oh, gosh.
Is she going to do these things for you? Probably not.
Yeah. But
is she going to do a lot of these things to you? Maybe if you're
your peer. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the final thing they get at level 22, shape change twice a day, is the 9th level magic user spell. Yeah,
nice.
Limited wish isn't the cap off shape changes.
Yeah, he could turn a dragon and unleash the fury of hell. I think that's the quote from Snow White. Not Snow White, Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, Sleeping Beauty, where Maleficent turns into the dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah.
I think it's near the very end when they're talking about the notes on the spells. If you're trying to, like a cleric, use a holy symbol to ward off an evil witch's spell, they get a +2 to the, you get a +2 to the save on the, on the, on the witch's spell.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then, yeah, because, yeah, then they get like a cumulative, they also get a magic resistance.
Right.
Yep, but 5% per level of the cleric. With the +4 bonus on all saves.
And beyond that, it's like, as far as alignment, I think it's pretty clear by the writing of the article, even they don't say it. It's pretty clear that they are somewhere on the evil spectrum.
How I would put them as up. Neutral evil.
Right. You could even have your good witches and it just would limit what abilities they get. So that way you can pull out some of the alignment. Like if some of the evil powers, they can't use it.
I guess you could have good aligned witches if their patron isn't a demon or a devil, obviously.
Right. Right. Have it be
you start getting to like hedge witches who are like just like nature witches.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's more nature god and the set. Yeah. So you could have something more along those lines. So that way you can have like your good witches, your bad witches. And then next thing you know, you are.
And then we burn more witches.
Yes. Oh. And then you start running the craft.
What a bad witch.
Yes. So.
The craft.
Yes. You start running the craft.
I just realized the movie Chronicle is just craft for the boys.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Or you can go charmed. You can go your charmed route if you want your episodic witchcrafty. Which actually wouldn't be a terrible place to steal ideas for things for witches, actually.
Yeah. I really like this class. I like what they're doing. I would never let a player be this.
Oh, no.
But I definitely would use them in the world.
Yeah, there's a huge breakdown of all the different the spell levels that are available. And they go into really good detail on what these spells do. Some of them, obviously, they're borrowed from either magic user, cleric, druid class, whatever. There's some unique ones, but, very detailed in that respect. I think it's pretty cool. Definitely NPC, like you said.
Oh yeah. It's absolutely an NPC. And then you take this NPC class, make your vit big bad, give them some of the curse, have the witch do one of the curses from the critical fumble article, and then boom, there's your campaign.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just one of those little, as I was just reading through it, I'm like, this is just hitting like all the high notes and capturing the flavor of the witch perfectly. And I think
I've got it. I've got the campaign.
All right.
All right. So a witch from the Salem witch trials escapes into hiding, eventually makes her way to the Old West, finds a lover who is like an outlaw, and the town kills him, and then she curses the town. And then a good witch who, I don't know, is somehow related to the bad witch. Maybe they're witch sisters. It's two witches. She's the one who brings the players from D&D World into Boot Hill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got it. You have your witch sisters. You they're both getting ready to be burned from the Salem witch. They escape, but then they go all Professor X Magneto split. One hates humans for trying to kill them. One was like, no, we can live in harmony with them.
Yeah. And, like, they end up in the Mojave Desert, and then eventually civilization, like, pops up, and the Good Witch definitely runs a brothel.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Best
the
cover.
Bad Witch, like, lives in a cave in Death Valley.
Right. Yes.
Now, if there is, if you do want to use a witch as a player character class, there is a way to do it. And if you want to borrow from second edition AD&D, if you look in that complete Wizard's Handbook, that splat book, there is a witch kit, a character kit template. You could probably use that one. I'm looking it over, and it's basically a much, much toned down version of the one in Dragon Magazine.
Hmm.
So I think that might be worth looking into if that's something you want to throw into your actual campaign, if you want to have that option to have his actual player character class. So,
right.
Just something to think about.
Yeah. Cause
all right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely something to check out if you haven't. So,
yeah, absolutely. So I guess going on from that, we'll, after checking out the witch who turned me into Newt,
but you'll get better.
I got better. We will move on to our last segment here, Sage Advice.
Sage Advice.
Last segment on our show, Sage Advice. And we do have a voicemail. And Matt will cue it up here in a second, and you can have a listen to it. And Matt, here we go.
Hey, RFI guys. This is DM Steve. Just wanted to say I find Crispy a lot less annoying recently, so I'm not gagging that much anymore. And I wanted to really applaud you guys for stepping back up with the new commitment to getting the podcasts out regularly. I find it really great that you guys are able to turn out the both the mini episodes and the regular episodes. And I enjoyed the one on the classic characters, and I'm not sure if that picture of the half orc looks like Vince or Nick or Crispy or Matt, but there he is. Talk to you guys later. Keep up the good work.
Oh, okay, thank you. The nice praise for our show. And we do have an email here from Goblin's Henchman. If you gotta be a henchman to a goblin. Wow.
The lowest of the low.
Right. You must be a kobold then. But Goblin's Henchman says, it's about our issue 197 we did about multiclassing. So put on your thinking caps for that. It says, hi, Vince, Nick, Matt, and Crispy. Got done listening to issue 197 on the multiclassing. And glad to hear all the pieces about multiclassing being brought together and discussed. He wasn't sure if it was Matt or Crispy that the gotcha question about half-elf bards. They're apparently allowable in the player's handbook, but if a half-elf can't be dual class, like all non-humans, how can they progress to be a bard?
Exactly.
That's why bards are in the appendix, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bards like, are...
They were tossed in...
Like psionics, yeah. They're also exactly. A mistake. Right.
Exactly. It's like... That's where I'd say... Here's a Dragon magazine that is, I'm trying to remember which one it was. I know it's in Best of Dragon Volume 3 that they had a write-up. It might have been Volume 2, but it was an early issue of Dragon. Someone did a version of the Bard where there's no like going from one class to the next, etc. So I think that's worth looking into there. So... That'll get away from the whole, like, well, half bards can't dual class, so half elves can't dual class to be bards, so how could they do it, blah, blah, blah. It gets away from all that.
I guess because, like, to be a bard, it's like you have to have so many levels of fighter, magic user, and thief, right?
Yeah.
So, half-elf can multi-class into those.
When you start off as a bard, you start multi-classed as or dual class as a. I want to say, is it
fighter thief? I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's basically or essentially dual classing.
Yeah.
And let me whip out the player's handbook here.
Yeah, I'm getting it as well.
So you basically progress exclusively as a fighter until you reach at least eighth level. So, and prior to attaining eighth level, so between five to eighth level, you could switch to dual classing over to be a thief. And somewhere between five to ninth level, you basically begin your studies as druids, and technically you're a first level bard from there. So it's kind of convoluted. I don't like that version.
Yeah.
I never have, because it seems like a lot of tracking that needs to be involved with that.
It's a lot of work and a lot of pre-planning on, like, okay, I need to do this for so long. Now I have to switch to this. You can't just be like, you know, I feel like being a bard. Nope.
Yep. Here's the character class. Go.
You can tell.
I'm trying to remember which issue of Dragon Magazine it is. That they had something about bards.
Yeah, because you can. And yeah, you can tell someone didn't really want bards in the game.
Yeah. And you know what? Here it is. It was in issue 56 of Dragon Magazine. That was December of 81. Or Best of Dragon Volume 3. There's a version of the bard here, which is so much better. It's straight off character class, no dual classing junk.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say take a look at that one, because that's the one I use in my AD&D campaign, along with the other one. They have there's a version of the monk that I like that's better in here too. But take a look at that. Issue 56, Dragon Magazine, or Best of Dragon, Volume 3 is a good one to avoid all that other junk with the appendix version of the bard in the player's handbook. He also goes on to say, been listening to the show for over 5 years, so you must be doing something right. Glad to hear you're back. I'm like, okay. Question for Matt, though. P.S. Question for Matt. How come you seem to know so much about gaming IP?
Well, you see, back in the day, I used to watch Tech TV a lot. Like, I would just turn it on and let it sit, like, back in, like, the early 2000s and the early days of Napster and all of that.
Yeah.
Which point, IP was a huge thing, and they would just talk about it a lot, so I picked up a lot through that. And then as years ago, a friend of mine also got involved in a trademark dispute with Miramax. He owned a trademark, had prior usage on national television of it. They went and made a movie using his trademark. Lawsuit ensues, and at which point I learned IP law in the U.S. is more based around who has more money to drag it out the longest, and you win by attrition.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So it was just through a lot of that, and then also just doing the show where some issues would come up, where we would see like lawsuits between Judges Guild and TSR and all that. So I'd just read up on that, like the stuff.
And Roll-Aids.
And Roll-Aids and all of that. So I just kind of read up on that and just kind of pick
them up. And not the antacid, folks.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I figured all that out. It's just through a combination of things. I also used to listen to a podcast years ago, This Week in Law, which was all like tech law. So patents, trademarks, copyright, all of those types of things. So,
and this is why we've gone so long without being sued.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Plus, also, since we're doing commentary, that gives us a little bit more leeway because you just don't do the wanton, I'm just stealing your stuff and not adding actually any new value or content.
Also, just like content that we use in between segments, like little audio snippets.
Right, exactly.
Actually, I think legally, when it comes to audio, you can have up to what?
There was
30
like
seconds?
Eight.
10 seconds.
I think most places go with eight, so that way they don't accidentally hit. I think it's 10, but most places make it a rule to go with eight, so that way they don't accident. If they let it play a little too long, they don't accidentally go over that.
Okay.
Because on Tech TV they mentioned something about that, and I think they said 8. Because I was a huge Tech TV fan back in the day. So.
And there's one here, I guess maybe for Matt or Crispy, another PPS. The idea of multi-classing divide XP by the number of classes, but each class can only level up when every class has enough XP to level up. In effect, the class has the slowest progression rate is the rate limiting step. Simples.
That was me.
That was you, Crispy. And we talked about it because I did the same thing too. You just have the one, you have your one total number of experience points. You just cross-reference to the table, and that's what level you are in that class.
Yeah.
Easy peasy lemon squeezy.
Yeah.
So, wishing us all the best from Goblin's Henchmen. So that's cool. And that's pretty much it for the show for this week. Let everybody know you can follow us on Twitter at RFI Podcast, or you can get a hold of Vince at the Evil DM or Matt at DGenX, DEGENX on Twitter. Also, you can contact us on our email, rfistaff@gmail.com. Or if you leave us a voicemail, like we had one earlier at 570-865-4210, all our goblin henchmen are standing by. And also you can go to Patreon, early show access there, and or you can go to Vince's blog, theevildm.com. So I believe we're done for this show. So keep it original, keep it old school, and we will talk to you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
See ya.
Roll for Initiative podcast is part of the Wild Games Productions Network and produced for entertainment purposes only. All other uses are prohibited. If you'd like to contact us, go to rfipodcast.com, click on contact us, or email us at rfistaff@gmail.com. Voicemail line 570-865-4210. Facebook.com/rfipodcast for more.